This is CliffCentral.com.
Pumi says it's getting warmer. I don't buy it for a second. She walked in here this morning so full of optimism about the fact that winter's saying goodbye. And then I reminded her August is still coming with the wind and everything else. How are you feeling now?
Same, Gareth. It's not optimism. Summer is coming, guy. It's like, it's not optimism. Oh, it's reality. It's going to be summer in 2 months' time.
When I'm driving into work and it's actually light, I'll believe you. And that's not going to happen for some time still. All right. Good morning, Canton Pillay. How are you?
I am awesome, apart from the fact that I had a dinner party to end all dinner parties last night.
Oh, really?
And
thanks for the invite, brew.
Pumi, I would not want you to be part of a crowd.
You think you have friends?
I would not want you to be part of a crowd. And you know, you need to have, you know, intimate gatherings where
That's why we do
where
this.
Where I can be contained.
That's why
we do this with you. So you obviously had a big dinner party that went on until late. Was there drinking involved?
There was significant drinking involved, but I've got to tell you, I made a venison roast that was absolutely divine. Yeah, it was a haunch of springbuck, which yeah, it was double
this
roast.
It's very baronial at the Pillay Mansion.
It is. Well,
a haunch of springbuck.
Listen, springbuck actually, you know, firstly, I'm a big fan of venison, simply because, you know, it's not factory farmed. You know, they live happy lives until the point at which that bullet actually takes them out. And so, you know, you have this picture of a springbuck.
We eat more like our ancestors. It's probably better for us in some way.
And also, it's significantly less expensive. I mean, you know, venison.
Where do you get it?
Checkers carries venison.
Really?
Yeah. I mean,
not ShopRite, Checkers.
Okay.
Checkers, not ShopRite, quite right. But Checkers carry venison because I think that they actually they own the farms that it comes
this
from.
This is good to know.
Yeah. But generally you can get springbuck for around about 70 rand a kilo, which is decent.
That's better than the price of the same amount of beef.
Beef and certainly
or lamb.
Yeah, and or less than half the price of the corresponding amount of lamb. Yeah.
All right. Well, you made it through. You woke up this morning, to your credit. You're here for the Burning Platform. We're also joined in a minute. We're going to speak to Junior. He's with the City Press, and he's been reporting on the Zondo Commission. Can we all take a moment to just revel in the fact that our former president has come out of a fairly quiet existence that he's been leading, certainly publicly, for the last couple of months? He may have been campaigning and creating chaos for the ANC, but it was largely undercover. Now he's out there and he's in front of the glare of the spotlights again. He's
I can summarize his defense though very quickly in the words of Bart Simpson. I didn't do it. Nobody saw me do it. You can't prove a thing.
Is that about right, Junior?
Good morning, firstly. Thank you so much for having me.
Welcome. Yeah.
Hi. Yes, that's just about right. That's what he's been doing the whole time. Like, I can't remember. I don't know what happened. I have no recollection of this. And he's been coughing a lot. So, yeah, that's what's been happening.
He tends to do that a lot when things are not going well. I remember when he was forced to resign as president, he was the whole time. So Junior Khumalo is a political journalist at the City Press. He's also a WITS Golden Key member and the 2017 WITS Vuvuzela Student Journalist of the Year. So congratulations on your career.
Thank
very
you so
impressive.
Much. That sounds...
you've been in the front row at the State Capture Inquiry watching the former president. Let's break down some of your observations. So you told us that the general idea is he's taking no responsibility here.
Yes.
Which, I mean, that's a standard Jacob Zuma thing. What else have you observed?
So from day one of the commission, of his appearance before the commission, he made it clear that he was appearing there under protest. So he said that the commission had brought him, these are his lawyer's words from yesterday. He said he was brought there under false pretense. They had told him that he was supposed to come and provide his version of events, of which now it seems like he's being cross-examined. So he was very unhappy about that, and he raised a concern yesterday, which led to the commission adjourning until tomorrow.
He's been saying a lot of the I don't remember stuff, which is concerning on two fronts. First of all, it means that he, while he was president, wasn't really aware of what he was doing, which is terrifying, if he's to be believed. Or he's just obfuscating because he knows that what he says here might have criminal consequences.
Yes.
Which are we led to believe based on the testimony so far and the opinion of experts?
I'm guessing it's a strategy from the former president, because from the get-go, he had a very lengthy opening remark of which he spoke about a whole conspiracy theory that was happening, and he never had anything substantial to corroborate that claim of his. And then after the opening remark, then there was nothing. Like, he wasn't giving anything away. He was being hostile. He had his legal team, which was waiting on the sides to just jump in and interject every time there was something that he
couldn't
didn't
afford to. A lawyer. The other day we heard he had no money for lawyers.
Yeah, he has three good lawyers, actually.
He has fantastic lawyers, yeah. But I have two things. Like, so Gareth, remember last week when Canton came in? Remember it was my birthday? Canton came in, he gave me some chai.
Yes.
Do you remember what I said to Canton about the chai?
Yes.
What?
You said that this stuff is very good for you. It's a salubrious stuff, and it smelled fantastic.
No.
What else did you say?
I asked him if it was homemade, and he said yes. And I said I don't want to presume, because he's Indian. He's homemaking the chai spice, right? You know, this is a conversation you and I had last week. You were in the room.
Yeah.
We all had this conversation,
and you
don't remember.
Okay, fair
and
enough.
Now you are asking a 70-plus-year-old man to remember conversations that happened 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Now, the thing about that is everything in our recollection happens because of the priority in which we place it. So if a conversation is high priority for me, I will remember more of it than you do. But I think more than that, for me, as I was sitting watching the commission, I was thinking, these are the limitations of what a commission is. A commission of inquiry is exactly, so it's not false pretenses. He was brought there to say, Guy, we just want you to tell us what happened? What happened in your view? And we're asking you what happened in relation to these 10 people's testimonies. Because those people, because it's an inquiry. And this is it's not court. That's why the big gay, you know, the big kind of skakane getting up and saying, but this guy is being cross-examined. And that's why Zondo has actually made the decision to say, let's adjourn here. We all have, yesterday his words were, we all have a job to do. The evidence leaders on the part of the commission have a particular job to do. I have a particular job to do. And Mr. Zuma's lawyers have a job to do. And all three of us, our jobs are different. And we can't prescribe to each other what those jobs are. But we have to find a way of moving forward in this thing. And this is what's happened to Zuma. He walked in there and all of us have decided that he is guilty. I don't know what people thought he was going to walk in there and say, right? Even though we're like, we just want to hear what happened. But now he's being put on the spot. And everybody, because he walks in there and we've decided he's guilty, we want to hear him say certain things. And if he doesn't say those things, we are unhappy about it. If he says he doesn't remember, we are unhappy about it. But why would he remember? If a conversation was low on his scale of importance, he may not remember what was being said then. It's 10 bloody years ago. You can remember what we said 7 days ago.
It's true.
Yeah. But, Canton, you're sitting here very quietly. Did you watch any of it?
Yeah, I've been watching it. As I said, you know, Zuma's defense is very clear. And he's just basically saying, hitting me with hearsay stuff. You know, I was not party to those conversations. So how can you ask me about those things? But fundamentally, the issue for me is that we are so distracted by these commissions right now that we are not focusing on the fact that the country has gone to hell in a handbasket. The economy is actually worse off now than it was during Zuma's time. Let's be very clear about that. Everyone has been saying that Cyril actually needs time to fix the economy, and it has not been happening. All of the steps that he could actually be doing to turn the economy around are not happening. In fact, we're barreling down this path of national health insurance scheme is now coming up, which is going to effectively destroy the last functional bit of the private sector in this country. Nobody's paying attention to it. We are all so distracted by the outrage around what's happening in terms of Zuma coming up there and saying that he can't remember. The money is gone. The money's gone to Dubai in suitcases. It's never coming back. And we are sitting there obsessed with wanting him to make a slip-up instead of actually focusing on saying, why is Cyril not fixing this country?
Mm. Where is Cyril?
Who knows? I want to go back to Junior for a second. So you're sitting there. First of all, just tell me who else is in attendance. What does this place look like when you're inside it? There's obviously Judge Zondo. There's obviously the evidence leaders. There are some lawyers. But who else is in the room?
So the main prominent political figures that have been attending the commission have been Ace Mahashule. There's been Supra Maumapelo, the former Free State Premier. So it's mainly people that have been loyal to Zuma, even when he was still the president, mm-hmm. and even after he left the presidency. Even David Van Rooyen, who was the finance minister for Des. The weekend. Yeah, Des Van Rooyen. Ah. So he was also in attendance. So a lot of people that are very loyal Zuma Carl supporters. Nihal. Yeah, Carl is also there. Dudu Zani was also there. So yes, also his family.
What happened
twins.
To the BLF?
Andile is not in there.
Andile is not in there.
Shame, the BLF wanted to get in, but they've just found out this week that they're not actually a political party. And second of all, they were barred from entering because they were wearing political party regalia.
Also, Andile was late for the accreditation process. So oh the accreditation God. Process was between 9 and 10.
Time.
Yes. So I don't understand why he was saying he was being barred because of what he was wearing. No one was really monitoring what people were wearing. He just came there late. Mm. So that's why they didn't allow him access into the commission.
That video yeah. that was making the rounds, there's an old guy that comes up to him. As he's complaining, there's an old guy that comes to him and says, "Oh, this dang accredited." I was like, yeah. This is us, the whole country. This man is representing the whole country. We are clear that this guy. And now that we know he was late, sis Dengenyan.
But also there's been a lot of crowds within the public gallery. And what's been interesting is that there's never been such a time where there's a witness and people started breaking out in song. So every time Zuma walks in, people yeah. literally just break out in song and start supporting him. So it's been interesting to watch and observe.
Yeah. Who
I wish he was speaking in Zulu. Every time I've watched, from the first day, I actually, when he started, I tweeted that I wish he was speaking in Zulu. And I'll tell you, the more I watch, the more I feel, even for Judge Zondo, I think he feels the same way. The number of times Judge Zondo has interjected to help Pretorius out, to say, "No, Mr. Zuma, I think what he means is this." And when Mr. Zuma answers, he then also has to be kind of a middle ground. I really wish he was speaking in Zulu because I think it would also change the way he is saying what he's saying. One of the big things that I saw is everybody talking about the suicide bomber thing. Now, Zuma said, "Itela gufa," you're right? And that's a Zulu word that's older than the idea of suicide bombers. That's actually a word that's a conjunction of two words. To ukdela is to resign yourself to something, and ugufa is to die, right? So it's actually more like. And Zuma also said, he said amadela gufa, and then when Pretorius kind of looked like what is he said like a suicide bomber. So everybody's just got suicide bombers attacking Zuma at a Maskande festival, but actually idela gufa is the closest English word would be like a daredevil, but it's actually a kamikaze.
Pumi, I need to interrupt you at this point because you're getting sidetracked. You have to understand the point around why Zuma is there. Because remember, let's go back to Zuma's rape trial. At his rape trial, he testified in Zulu the entire way through. Mm-hmm. Okay, because at his rape trial, he had to be.
There was consequence.
There are consequences. He had to be very precise. He had to be on point, and so he testified in Zulu the entire way. Now, his appearance before the commission, he is playing to the media. That's why he's there. Mm-hmm. And that's why it is so important for him right now to be testifying in English, even though he would be far more
adept.
Yes, thank
but
you, Gareth.
He's enjoying this. He's also
enjoying it.
He's a supremely great victim. Like, he's the best victim of all victims. He makes it look like everybody was against him. All of these stories about poor me, woe is me, I've done so poorly. You're all so mean to me. Look at, I'm being dragged in front of this commission. Wah, wah. The formerly the most powerful man in this country who determined the destiny of South Africa and made some horrendous mistakes and ran it like a badly managed board game. He's now claiming that he's been victimized. If the media are going to be led by the nose on this, then they're morons. There's just no, I don't buy any of it. I cannot find it in me to be sympathetic.
Yeah, and I don't think that any one of us should be sympathetic. However, I do think we should be fair and we should be just. And we should give him, and the commission should have actually said to him at some point, should have said to him, look, it's probably better if you have this. Because what we want actually, because we want justice, is we don't want a situation 3 years from now where the man is saying, oh, I didn't understand you to be saying that. That's not what I understood you to be asking me.
I agree with the Zulu thing, but I think Canton raises a good point that this is theatre to him.
Exactly. It's theatre. And
we have been sucked into it.
We have totally been sucked into it, and it's distracting us from the fact that, I mean, you guys have heard about this thing at the Mount Nelson in Cape Town.
What happened? There was a robbery?
Yeah, they were held up at gunpoint, and the armed thugs basically ransacked the place, took money from the guests, and
Canton is right in that we're sitting here, we're not talking about the kind of falling apart of the entire auditing profession in this country. We're not talking about what's happened at Deloitte. We're not talking about the fact that Unilever is sitting in front of the Competition Commission about having misled its consumers around the weight and nutritional value of some of the products that they've got on their shelves. We're not talking about the number of businesses that are being shut down. We're not rolling up our sleeves and working. So the whole concept of a commission to begin with was always about theatrics. Mm-hmm. It was always about theatrics.
Well, I think that's what Canton's saying. But I do think that there is a role for this commission, because in future, because ultimately you have to pay the price for your crimes. And there's a crime that has been committed against this country, a large-scale financial grand larceny crime. And there are going to be, whether it's now or it's a year in the future or 10 years into the future, there are going to be criminal proceedings invoked by somebody, whether it's a citizen who does it, whether it's the criminal procedure elements of the criminal justice system inside the government. Someone is going to be accountable, and this evidence is going to be the first port of call. So everything that's said here, even if it is just I don't knows or throat clears or Zulu or English or anything else, it's going to eventually be part of something that is going to be instituted as a criminal proceeding. So it does actually matter, even if it's a symbolic and theatrical thing at this stage for us. I'm interested, you brought up this criminal stuff. I mean, we're seeing that people have James Small died, Mark Batchelor was shot, Johnny Clegg has died. This is not a great week.
It's not a good week for us.
For white males in particular.
Gareth, I'm going to think about you
for
the rest
careful.
Of the week.
I'm going to be very careful this week. Do we think that all of this is also, certainly in the Mark Batchelor case, this rampant criminality? I mean, we're probably led to believe that this is some kind of mob hit, that there's some kind of underworld element to this. But there is an underworld, and Jacob Zuma dipped his toes in that underworld quite significantly.
Yes, indeed. And but fundamentally what it comes back to is the inability of the African National Congress to implement rule of law in the country.
Mm-hmm.
This is not something that has suddenly popped up. It's been part of a steady decline over all of the years that the ANC has been running the country, that, you know, the degradation and the inability of the police to actually carry out investigations and take them through to arrest and finally to imprisonment because of the fact that they are fundamentally incompetent. The inability of police to read, write, and count is such a huge stumbling block in even beginning to tackle what's going on with this underworld of ours. And now we have Becky Cele, who's now sitting as Minister of Police. And the point has been made that he's never been a policeman. He actually doesn't understand the processes and procedures that need to be put in place to run a functional police force. And so he lacks the ability to actually fix it.
And the police is the first line of kind of how this whole system is meant to work.
Yes, absolutely.
I just wanted, while Junior is still here, because I don't want to abuse your time and not get the best out of you, Junior. The former president, mentioned in his testimony that Nwako Ramahlodi was a spy, Sipiwe Nyanda was a spy. All of these people are trying to take him out. There are foreign agencies trying to run the country. These are old tropes. This is standard, you know, kind of Russian KGB practice, that you blame everybody else as a spy, and then you claim that there's some, you know, evil, insidious foreign force.
Well, the Hirfer Commission basically came because he said that Bulalani Nkuka was a spy at the time.
That's right. Mm. This is his standard thing. This is from the old playbook.
Yeah, no, that's definitely true. But the thing is, he had no collaborating evidence to prove all of this.
He's moaning about how everything we say about him is hearsay, but he's doing the same thing
he's
about
these.
He's
doing the exact same thing. But it's funny how when the current Secretary General of the ANC appeared before the commission, he also kind of hinted that Zuma might be true in saying that. Of which, what does that do to the ANC? Because in the May 8 elections, it did dismally. So this is continuing to affect the ANC as a party. So,
well, I mean, it's clear that Ace Magashule will do whatever he can to stay out of jail himself, because there are pending problems on his criminal charge sheet, which we know are likely to be enforced or at least undertaken and investigated at some point. So you're dealing with two people here who are in a corner. Ace and Gedlihlekisa, they know that their time is coming, and they're really just trying to buy some time by throwing a whole lot of incendiary stuff at other people.
That's true.
I mean, have Ramatlodi and Nyanda said anything about this?
Ramatlodi has flatly denied all these allegations. He has even called for a polygraph test between him and Zuma to see who's lying between the two of them.
So
that's an interesting one. Yes. He also went after Reddy Tlamy, and the journalist.
Yeah.
He said she's making a film in America about the rape trial
Raped
that he
by
faced.
Power.
Yes, and that's the title apparently. And she also flatly denied it. She said, "Where did you get this information?" So I'm guessing because he claimed in the beginning that he was a former head of the intelligence in the ANC, we're supposed to believe everything that he says.
Well, he's also, he keeps on threatening, there's this kind of veiled critique that he has information and you all better be careful because he'll let your small Anyana skeletons out of the cupboard. He keeps on threatening this, which is anyone who says that should be forced to admit everything they know.
That's true. Even when he was appearing before the Pietermaritzburg High Court in May, he claimed that there are people that he's going to name drop when he gets to the Zondo Commission. So we've been waiting. He's named Ramatlodi and called him a spy, but we thought that there are other ANC political heavyweights that he was going to name and say what they're doing.
This is reactive because Siphiwe Nyanda and Nwankwo Ramatlodi, they're the two people who have testified against him so far, or not against him, but they've given their version at the Zondo Commission, which has implicated him quite severely.
Sure.
So he's merely reacting to them and has now come up with a nice story about them being spies. If someone else comes up with something about him, he'll no doubt have an allegation about them being a spy as well. What we'd like to know is the stuff he already had on his piece of paper before he came, before the Zondo Commission.
Come and
tell us all of it.
He says Ramatlodi was a spy and he was recruited when he was studying in Lesotho, and yet he's the one who appointed Ramatlodi as minister. So if he knew that he was a spy, it doesn't make sense that he would appoint
him minister.
Yeah. True.
I mean,
so
ditto in the case of Nyanda, because
he made
Nyanda
him
minister as
minister
well.
Of defense.
He was communications.
That's right. Defense. Yeah. Before then, he was a general.
Yes.
That's right.
Yeah.
He wasn't. He wasn't minister of defense. Mm-hmm. Correct. All right, so can we dispense with him? Do we need to pay any more attention to him? Is he coming back?
It's highly unlikely that he's going to come back. The commission is sitting again on Friday, but I'm assuming that he's not going to come back. I think if he's going to come back before the commission, the commission's legal team will have to subpoena him to come back. So.
All right. Well, let's stop being distracted then, Canton.
All right.
Poor Junior is going there every day. It's part of his work, and you're telling him he's wasting his time.
But I have to ask, Junior, I must ask you this one thing, which is not so much about the commission and the evidence that's been kind of shared this week. Mm-hmm. But for you, as you know, a young journalist sitting there in the sands, what has been the most fascinating part of this entire experience? Have you been going there throughout the commission?
Yes, from the beginning.
What has been your most fascinating part of this experience?
I think for me, Angelo Agresti's testimony was the most astonishing, because in the beginning, as you had said, that people had already made up their minds that state capture was orchestrated by Zuma and the Gupta family. Like, some of us did not understand that there were other players, there were other protagonists in the whole thing. So the revelation of the Watsons, Bosasa, their involvement in all of that, shocking. It was shocking for me. So yeah, that should be part of the standout from the time that I've been attending it.
So you're the future of journalism because you're a young journalist of the year, right? And everybody, at least here in South Africa, but also around the world, is talking about a decline in journalism. So for you, sitting there and everybody says your profession is dying, what do you think you could do differently and in terms of reporting on all of these kinds of things to, you know, keep yourself relevant into the future?
Let's give him a real opportunity. What could your bosses do differently to save the profession?
I think... I work for City Press, so we are a publishing media house. But also now that we've seen that there is a move to social media. So that's why when we are in the commission, we tweet from the commission, mm-hmm. we use social media. So it's using different platforms to engage with people and just knowing what people would want. So trying to get those interviews with the relevant people in the commission and keeping people informed, because no mm-hmm. one wants to wait for Sunday to read the paper. People mm-hmm. want to know what's happening in the commission today. So if you keep in touch with them, inform them on what's happening, then I'm guessing you're keeping the profession alive.
Good for you. Thank you very much for coming to see us this morning.
Good luck. You're exciting. Thank you so much. It's exciting to be with you.
This is very cool. Thank you very much for being part of it. All right, Kanthan and Pumi, I want to talk about something else while we let Junior go.
Of course you do.
Well, there's lots going on. I mean, we could talk about a bunch of things. I know that Kanthan said one of the things he feels that we need to discuss this morning, not because of any symbolism or because we're necessarily mournful or any of this stuff, but Johnny Clegg was a symbol of something which I think we've moved away from in South Africa. I saw an interesting thing yesterday by some activist on social media who has like 100 followers, but this activist said, you know, Johnny Clegg, good riddance to cultural appropriation. And I feel that this is something which keeps coming up and rearing its ugly head every time anyone who has actually done something for nation building or for unity or for kind of doing and showing the best of what South Africa could be if we were Desmond Tutu's Rainbow Nation. I know it's decried by a lot of people, but this idea of cultural appropriation is just so poisonous. It means effectively that we should live in silos. It means effectively that racism has won. And I don't like this at all. I remember Johnny Clegg sitting in the studio with me under a year ago, telling me the story of how he used to go into these hostels as a small child at 14 or whatever, and spend time with these Zulu men. It's where he learnt all of his musical skills. It's where he learnt the language. It's where he understood the culture. It's what made him study anthropology, among other things. And he was such a lover and a fan of the South African Zulu, but more the migrant labor Zulu culture in the hostels. He loved it with every fiber of his being. And to have that questioned post-death is just such a lazy attempt by whoever this person was on social media to make it about them.
It's wokeism, man. It's wokeism in 154 characters. Because in reality, when you get to know about Johnny Clegg and about his work, what you understand is that, and this is the difference between what appropriation versus being an anthropologist and a lover of different cultures, is Johnny Clegg absolutely understood his privilege. He absolutely understood that he's a white man in black spaces. He understood that as a white man in a space where he shouldn't be, he was and for him, it was, he was seeking out something that in his soul he wanted to know more about. He wasn't trying to be it just for his Instagram. He wasn't it wasn't a veneer. But this is the problem with kind of 154 characters of wokeism, is now you have to be incendiary in one way or another.
I remember, you know, as a young journalist, going back to the phrase that Pumi was using just now, when I was 19 years old, and I'd been a journalist for a couple of months at the time, and I saw Juluka performing at the student union at University of Natal, as it was back then. And the student union was absolutely packed. And there was this small stage that had been set up. And these guys were utterly electrifying. And understand that this was the heart of, you know, the dark days of apartheid. You know, the state of emergency was on the horizon coming along. And there were these guys in defiance of the entire bans on mixed race performances and all of that stuff that was part of our day-to-day existence at the time. And we had the student union absolutely packed out with, you know, everyone. It was that Rainbow Nation that we are talking about. And it was brought together because of the fact that these guys were there. They were putting together this electrifying performance. So it was Johnny and Sipo, and I think it was Robbie Jansen was part of their backing band as well. And the crucial thing that these guys were doing back then is that they were telling stories through their music. I mean, once they got to the scattering stage, they became very commercial. But you go back to their earlier albums, and it was storytelling of, you know, that it was gritty stuff about day-to-day life that was affecting predominantly black South Africans.
And stories that kind of we've lost a grip on, like masculinity and stick fighting and dominance and culture, and how in that male culture they were talking about, which Johnny really articulates better than anyone else. And if you listen to the interview yesterday, or you want to go and listen to it, it's still there. He told the story of how, you know, you start off and you're in fun and you end up as a getla, and you kind of in between go through all these stages of being a man, which is, to me, stuff we've forgotten. And stuff a lot of people don't grow up with anymore, because they don't necessarily have that male role model or that male community that they belong to. It's why so many young men in South Africa are probably quite wayward.
And, you know, I think for me, more than anything, and I remember being kind of young and in the hood, between Johnny Clegg and PJ Powers, suddenly you see this person that's very different to what you're used to seeing. And they are, because of the magic of music and storytelling, they don't have that boundary. But the thing about it is, it's about the respect for what it is. And as that's the thing about being an anthropologist, you know, and for all the young people that are still deciding what it is that they want to study, it's definitely one of the things that, if you're not sure where you want to go to, start there. Because it's about immersing yourself and without judgment, mm-hmm. which is something Twitter has kind of, you know,
that never happens on Twitter,
taken away from us. But without judgment, just getting to know, getting to learn, getting to immerse yourself without losing yourself. Johnny never lost who he is. He never lost who he is. He was still a white guy. Everywhere he went, he was still a white guy.
Sure.
He was just the white guy that spoke Zulu. He was just the white guy that, you know, danced in Ramu. He was, but that's...
But I think there was, and this is the point that that irritates and frustrates the hell out of me, is that people who cry about cultural appropriation are not not aware of the fact that there are things that cultures can give each other, which can be tremendously positive. I mean, here you were with your spices the other day for Pumi,
which are amazing. I mean, by the way, this amazing.
Is this not a kind of cultural exchange which is to be welcomed?
Well, I unashamedly appropriate culture whenever I come across it.
Yeah,
venison hunch.
I go traveling to, you know, I go to Korea and I discover bulgogi, and I come back home and I cook it because, you know, it's I love it.
I love so many things about cultures which are not the ones that I descend from, and they are things that give me huge amounts of joy, whether it's music or food or art or any of these things. What kind of a person would want to close themselves up from that? I don't understand it. It's really mind-boggling.
But it's effectively thought policing. That's what we're trying to do.
Yeah, and I suppose it comes from the same source. You know,
the one thing that I can say in terms of Johnny Clegg, it is so good to look back, you know, from my side at Johnny Clegg's career and only have good things to think about the person. You know, and that so rarely happens. You know, when you take James Small, for example, you know, I mean, yes, he's a good rugby player and by all accounts, a terrible human being.
Yeah.
And the thing about Johnny Clegg, I remember when I moved back to Joburg after coming back to the country, post 94, and I used to hang out at Emerentia Dam quite often, and Johnny used to come and hang out there with his family. And you know, he was just this regular guy kicking back, enjoying life in Johannesburg, and, you know, just having fun.
And I think more of us should learn from that experience. We should learn from the experience of extending ourselves outside of our places of comfort, just to learn, to get to know other people, to get to know other people's way of life with respect. You don't have to judge it.
Couldn't agree more.
Get to know it and then decide if you know, but don't judge it on the from the outset.
Speaking of respect, we've got to look at Donald Trump as we do every now and then, and this is a man who's who's got a bit of a problem with understanding how he should and shouldn't tweet, among other problems that he has.
Behave.
So he went online and he criticized these four freshman congresswomen who are Rashida Tlaib, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, and there's one other one who's I can never recall. She's almost like the fifth Beatle. No one really knows their name. The point is that these four women have been called out by Donald Trump for being America haters, and he said to them effectively, go back to the countries you came from. The irony is that three of them are American. One of them comes from Somalia.
Well, that's not exactly what he said. He said, if you don't like it here, then go
then
away.
You can go away. And you can come back and teach us their successes when you come back.
Sure. Exactly. Yes. So he didn't say go back to where you came from. That, I think that's a spin that people have been putting. But
nonetheless, it's not a good thing for a leader.
You need to understand what's going on out here. Okay. So what's actually going on out here is you've got the squad and then you've got the Democrats. And right now, the squad has been defining the agenda in terms of what the public perception is around what the Democratic Party is all about. Mm-hmm. Now, in the build-up to the
presidency, Nancy Pelosi's been pushing up against that, obviously.
Exactly. Because Nancy Pelosi is well aware that in order for the Democrats to be able to come up with a candidate that's going to be able to defeat Donald Trump in the polls, it needs to be someone who is a centrist of sorts.
Yeah. Mm.
Because right now it's actually impossible to unseat Donald Trump. And so there has been this push to try and, with Pelosi's push has been to try and say, well, actually, the agenda of the Democratic Party is not what's represented by the squad. The agenda of the Democratic Party is that, you know, we're actually pushing through legislation in the House on a regular basis that's actually trying to solve real problems that's going on in the country. And what Donald Trump has done very effectively is to swing the attention back to the squad by forcing the Democrats to now close ranks around the squad and to then say that Donald Trump is being racist. He is pushing the agenda exactly where he needs to have it.
So this is highly manipulative. Highly manipulative.
I get that, but we don't ever want a situation where the leader of a country says, if you don't like the way this is going, go somewhere else.
It's
copping out of an argument. So while I agree with the strategy, and I think it's a very good idea to make it about the squad because they're terrible and people don't like them and then they're hugely unpopular. I think they've altogether got about a 9% approval rating from the American population. They're not a very popular bunch of women. But Donald Trump has now made it about them, and I get that politically that's a great strategy. However, for a leader of a country to say, you know, if you don't like what we're doing here, then you should try somewhere else. I mean, everybody in a
country. But the ANC says this to white people in this country all the time.
I know, I have a problem with it.
Yes, but we have to understand that that's the nature of politics these days. Wherever you go throughout the world, that's the way people are actually doing things.
It has become an incredibly polarized environment. I mean, there's a video going around of Donald Trump at a rally about this morning when we woke up, at least that's when the video came out. As he is speaking, that entire crowd starts chanting, go back to where you're from. And so, and what it is, but it's what you see with kind of, with Pelosi and with Trump is you see politics at its down and dirtiest. Yeah. Like Pelosi doesn't know how to deal with a president like Donald Trump, doesn't know how to deal with the candidate like Donald Trump. But what's also fascinating to see is how the kind of push from the squad, right, against Nancy is breaking apart the only opportunity that they do have on the left of kind of coming back and bringing sanity back to prevail, you know. And it's just watching that kind of politics makes you understand how amateur our politics is over here. You know, you see very mature kind of politics playing out over there. It's new age politics in the way that Donald Trump is doing stuff. And Nancy Nancy doesn't have what...
She's kind of a relic.
She doesn't have what it takes to... But that's why Canton says he's undefeatable. Donald Trump is undefeatable. Next year, 2020, Donald Trump is coming back.
Who do you think would give him the best run for his money as a Democratic candidate for 2020?
Say again?
I think that if you look in terms,
the best candidate
in
to
terms
run against
in
him.
Terms of a centrist candidate who's had a generally good track record, probably Biden is the closest person. But you know, Biden's chances have now been shot to hell because of the likes of Kamala Harris, who've you know, effectively turned around and said that you know, he doesn't count because he's a white male and you know he was racist and. Yeah, in terms of the debate that they had, and you know, at which point. So, right now, if you understand the historical context around how the Democrats used to be successful, and I think Obama, before
they owned slaves or after?
After they owned slaves. Okay. I mean, I think Obama is a very good example of, because Obama actually knew how to work behind the scenes and have discussions with people across the board and get them to come on board in terms of his agenda. Ted Kennedy was a past master at that, you know, in terms of the legislation that he managed to get through. And all of it was all about the fact that you work behind the scenes, you have discussions with both sides of the House, and you come to a point of agreement before legislation actually gets tabled.
Right.
And right now, everything that's happening is an us versus them scenario. And that is going to be the way of the future, because the inherent... nature of liberal politics, and I'm using liberal in the classic sense. Liberal politics ultimately ends up being conservative to the extent that it doesn't try to rush through change too rapidly so that people get scared of it. And we've seen that scenario right now where everything is all about trying to rush through pieces of legislation that people immediately want to recoil from. So we're not going to go back to that stage. So we've got now Donald Trump recognizing that what he has to do is to define the Democrats as being represented by the squad.
And that's what he's doing.
And that's what he's doing.
And he, this is probably why he's likely to win again next year, because he's made it look like the Democratic agenda is being...
Yes. Now, when the Democrats turn around and say that he's a racist, now, Donald Trump is probably a racist. Let's be very clear about this. But the term has become so overused that...
It's got no teeth anymore.
It's got no teeth anymore.
Social media is being called a racist. Left, right, and center. I heard people the other day saying Obama wasn't black enough and this kind of thing. So for the woke people, everyone is bad.
Yes.
Everyone.
And so when there's no nuance anymore, that the term actually goes away. But... he has forced the agenda. I have to say that the guy actually understands how to manipulate the opposition and get them into that constant state of outrage, which just simply positions them as...
lunatics.
As lunatics, yes. And he comes across as the reasonable person.
Well, they had a press conference. This is what I found interesting. He didn't actually mention any of them by name. He just said there are these communists in the... that's what he called them.
Yes.
There are these ladies, these communists... And then they held a press conference, which was the stupidest thing for them to do, because they could have kept quiet and been dignified about it and said, you know, let Nancy go up and say, you know, don't attack these women. You're a racist and you're a bigot, and what you're doing here is you're basically you're going after on an ad personam basis some very responsible young women who are trying to make a difference in society. Instead, they subverted her again, Nancy. They went and held their own press conference, and it derailed almost instantly. Because then they started to go down the impeachment route, which we know is a dead herring, a red herring, sorry. We know that a dead ringer.
A dead
red herring. We know that these three women have very strong opinions on a number of things. But when they're questioned about, for example, you know, decrying the firebombing of an ICE facility by Antifa, none of them can find a voice. They're immature politicians. That's all they are. They need more time in the job. And if you look at what's coming up in 2020, it's unlikely any of these four women will be re-elected in any of their districts. So they're in big trouble. And they've put themselves out there now. They're in the firing line. And if America's forced to choose between Donald Trump and that squad, they're going to choose Donald Trump.
I think that's very much going to be the case. Right now, I cannot see any of the Democratic candidates actually being able to become the rallying point. That, I mean, frankly, right now, the way things are going, if the Democrats really wanted a candidate to put forward, they should probably bring Hillary back. No, really. And just on the basis that none of the others right now seem to have anything.
Crooked Hillary.
And but you see,
isn't she going to be busy defending Bill against being on Epstein's Island soon?
But you see how adept Donald is at this, because he's also kind of his strategists are on point, because he's also kind of looked at it and gone in the ether somewhere. This, and so what does he come out to say? Arrest Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. So he's come out of the starting blocks first to say, even as they, this is, you know, so it's not big news yet that he's saying arrest Hillary Clinton, but
book.
He's going to bring
I
it
read
out
a
there.
Book sometime in the late 90s, early 2000s by Christopher Hitchens called No One Left to Lie To. Do you remember this book?
No.
It was about
the Clintons. It was about Bill and Hillary and how crooked and wretched and evil they are. And, you know, Hitchens didn't really have any sacred cows. He went after Mother Teresa. And he was one of the foremost and the most erudite intellectual voices of our age. When he died, I genuinely mourned. This guy wrote this book some time ago. It is an unbelievable expose of just how power-hungry and dangerous Bill and Hillary Clinton were. And at the time, I thought, look, maybe it was a little barbed and unnecessary, and maybe he'd gone a little bit too far into criticizing their characters and comparing them to demons and so on. But the evidence was incontrovertible, and there's stuff in there about Whitewater and all the other controversies that the Clintons were involved in, Paula Jones, the Bill Clinton sex allegations, Monica Lewinsky later on, and a number of other things. But it also goes into the character of these two people. And this predates Trump's criticism of Hillary and calling her crooked and everything else. But there's an element of something there that we all missed, and which the Clintons, through their manipulation of the mainstream media, and remember, they're very connected people. These are political elites at the very top of the pyramid. And between Bill and Hillary, they've hoodwinked tons of people over the course of years. And when Donald said crooked Hillary, it sort of struck this resonant chord with a number of people who just knew deep down inside there was something not right about these Clintons. Turns out, after, you know, a number of email leaks and Anthony Weiner going to jail and a lot of other things that have started to make it very muddy for Hillary and Bill, and the fact that they're Broadway show was canned after 2 weeks of empty theaters. They didn't put it on, let's be fair. It was about them, though. No one wanted to see it. At a Billy Joel concert, now Billy Joel is a New York icon. He can do no wrong in New York. Billy Joel was the guy who, after September the 11th, held those concerts to rebuild New York. He's a New Yorker through and through. He's written all the songs about New York. He dedicated a song to Bill and Hillary Clinton at his concert in Madison Square Garden not so long ago. The crowd started booing. Billy Joel. There's something going on here that we need to take note of. And these Clintons are out. They're finished. No one's booking them for gigs anymore. They can't get a platform like they used to. There's something happening there that I think Donald picked up on. If nothing else, the guy's got a good sixth sense for what's going to work and what's not going to work, or what he can sell and what he can't sell. And I think he found gold when he started calling Hillary crooked.
Well,
something's happened.
Certainly he's defined the agenda around Hillary at that point. But you understand the point, the core point that I'm trying to make is that the Democrats do not have someone at this point that they can actually put forward that is likely to be a challenger that's able to take on Donald and defeat him at the polls.
No, there are no ideas left in the left, unfortunately.
That's a hell of a note to end it on. Let's wrap it up right there. We've said it all. Sheesh, what a burning platform. Anyone who thought that this show wasn't... I said to Canton and Pumi last night on a WhatsApp, you know, it doesn't have to be an hour. We don't have to talk for an hour. We can keep it shorter if you want to. I'd rather keep it really punchy. Canton says, if it ever gets dreary, I'm gone long before then.
The hour is way too short.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, thank you for joining us for the Burning Platform. It's brought to you by Nando's. Whew, today was very, 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 very hot.
Yeah, man.
You want to hear more?
Summer is coming.
Yeah, of course. That's what Bumi keeps saying. I'll believe it when I feel it. It is now 5 minutes to 8.
This is CliffCentral.com.